I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Richard Rhodes. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 25 books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb, Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb, and Why They Kill. And Dr. Ginger Rhodes, who is a licensed clinical psychologist in San Francisco specializing in trauma treatment, and her practice also includes the psychological evaluation of trauma survivors who are seeking political asylum in the United States. The two of them will be giving a talk titled Why We Kill, Violence as Socialization. It's tonight, Wednesday, the 12th of November at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, free and open to the public and sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you have studied human violence and homicide in specific, and violence seems to be both part of our nature as primates and very much a function of both our socialization and of our political structures. Homicide rates vary widely depending on the society and the historical era. What determines whether there is a high or low murder rate in any given place and time?
Social controls over violence. If you look, for example, at medieval Europe, homicide rates were up in the 50s or even higher per 100,000, which is comparable to the worst inner cities in the United States or some of the more violent places in the world. Europe managed over centuries of evolution toward centralized governments to find ways to reduce that level to levels that today are historically low. So is the same case in the United States. Europe today, typically homicide rate of 1 to 1.5 per 100,000, very low. The United States a little bit higher, about 4.7 per 100,000 in the most recent numbers. And I just interject here, if you take gun deaths out of that number, it's still higher than Europe. It's about half of that 4.7, but it's considerably above 1.0 or 1.5. Now, the main thing that happened was common people slowly acquired access to courts of law and could settle their disputes in court rather than using weapons. The advent of police forces, which I think most people think of as our professional controllers of violence, actually came rather late. First urban police force were the famous London Bobbies, who arrived on the scene in 1829. By then, England's homicide rate had descended from in the 20s per 100,000 down to modern lows. So it was not so much police and policing that made the change, but it was finding alternative ways of allowing people to settle disputes and bringing violence under centralized control, and paralleling that, changes in child-rearing practices away from violently socializing children.
Well, this child-rearing business, I didn't know until I read one of your articles that even kings of France were horribly beaten. I mean, at least in Europe, I don't know about the rest of the world, but child-rearing was, for many people, violent business.
And in most societies in the world today, to some degree, still is, including in pockets of our society, our own. One of the main influences on the changes in child-rearing practices was actually the church. When I looked at the case of King Louis XIII, the father of the famous Louis XIV, Louis XIII was beaten every morning with a switch on awaking by one of the people hired to do that because his father believed that that would cure him of the sin of pride. When his father, when he was 8 years old, was assassinated and he was crowned King of France, he told the doctor who was assigned to take care of him, you know, I'm glad that the people love me, but I wish you'd just stop having me beaten every morning. And it was not until he was old enough to put a stop to those daily beatings himself that he was able to free himself of that. Now, why would someone beat someone every day? Well, there we get into the question of how people are taught and socialized to be violent.
Well, let's get into that. You write about a criminologist named Lonnie Athens who studied a large number of convicted murderers and then came up with a four-stage process of violent socialization that was common to all of them, like 100% of them. Tell us a little about those four stages.
Four stages that begin with violent mistreatment, as we would consider it, what Athens calls violent domination of children, typically within the family, but this process doesn't have to happen within families. It can happen in the streets, in gangs and so forth. But Athens found with most of the violent criminals he studied that they had typically, by the age of 8, been subjected to serious violent domination. And I think Dr. Rhodes here can explain that better than I.
The four stages, the important thing about the stages is that these experiences that people have, as Richard mentioned, mostly in their childhood, though it certainly can happen in their adult years. I mean, military training is one example of that. But the thing about these experiences is they're not just everyday experiences. They're significant experiences that have distinct and influential impact on kids. And the first stage is called brutalization. And there's three parts to that stage, but the common element of this is that it's harsh treatment by someone in we'll call him the novice, in their primary group. And a primary group is a person from an intimate group where they have regular contact. So, for instance, it could be a family, but it also could be a clique, you know, a close group, or a gang. And in this first stage, these harsh treatment elements that happen, it's more than just child abuse. In fact, Athens is clear about not calling it child abuse. Child abuse is a normative term. Not everybody agrees on what child abuse means. I mean, we've recently had that example of the football player who had beaten his child. And there was a big debate for several days about whether that was child abuse or not. So the other thing about this not necessarily being child abuse is that child abuse is experienced inside a family. And brutalization can happen inside the family or outside the family. But the three parts of that first stage are violent subjugation, personal horrification, and violent coaching. And what violent subjugation is where this novice is forced to acquiesce control to some authority figure. And that's a person from their primary group and a person who is credibly violent. And the person threatens the novice with either physical acts, I'm going to beat you up, or threats of those acts. And the threats alone can work because that individual is credibly violent. Again, if you think about in the military training, a drill sergeant is not able to beat up or recruit somebody in basic training, but he certainly is able to threaten him, and that threat impacts that recruit substantially.
Let me just intercede here and say it appears, and I think this is one of the tests of the credibility of Athens' research, it appears that militaries adapted this violent socialization process to train soldiers to be prepared to use violence to protect the rest of us, adapted it to basic training where recruits are broken down and humiliated. And then they go through the violent coaching that Ginger mentioned, which is basically telling people that they have a responsibility to use violence in defense of themselves and the people they value. And then, crucially, they're rewarded. And this is a part of this violent socialization process. They're rewarded for using violence within the context of military combat training. What you end up with then is someone who learns to use violence, but also learns to think of themselves as violent individuals up to a degree. It's very tricky with violent socialization to keep those whom we consider to be professionals who take care of violence for us at the level of being only defensively violent, only using violence in defense of themselves and the people they value. That's stage three of this violent socialization process, which Ginger described the initial stage as brutalization. The next step is when the violent and the novice, having been humiliated and turned into a victim by this dominance that's being imposed on him by credibly violent people in his primary group, starts thinking about the question, what am I going to do to spend my life not being pushed around by other people and dominated in this way? And that's where the violent coaching has a crucial role. The violent coaching has told him, you have a responsibility to use violence yourself in order to protect yourself and everyone around you from being treated this way.
We're talking to Richard and Ginger Rhodes about violent socialization. What you're talking about is something that seems to apply very much to, for example, gangsters and mafiosi and things like that. And in fact, as I was reading about these four stages, I was thinking about which television shows and movies are more and less accurate, because I mean, some crime shows will have some perfectly nice housewife who just snaps and kills somebody or whatever, which doesn't really seem like that's accurate. It's like most people who kill actually do go through all four stages of this violent socialization.
I think you could say all people. The idea that people snap is a strange idea. I mean, it's kind of parallels the idea that you can learn to be violent by watching violent television. What's crucial in violent socialization in the stage after the brutalization stage is that the person actually has to try violence. He's not going to learn to be violent by watching other people be violent. He has to try it himself. He has to take that risk. And really, if you think about it, if someone decides to confront, let's say, a bully who's been violently dominating them around school, or a violent parent who's threatening and larger and dangerous, they're risking their lives, potentially. They're certainly risking getting a serious beating.
I want to underscore that because I think that's really important to keep in mind. So often as adults, we think about making choices based on what we do as adults. But we're talking about kids here. You know, we're talking about kids as young as very young. You know, toddlers start experiencing this violent domination by people. And by the time kids are ready to put together this not only mistreatment and watching others important in their life who are mistreated, but also this idea that they're the ones who have to take it under control to do something about what they're experiencing. By this time, we're talking about maybe 10 to 12-year-olds. So just if you think about the size alone, the size differential with little kids or even moderate kids and adults, takes a big risk to make that first retaliation move. You know, it's a really big risk to try to take action into your own hands.
Of course, guns can equalize the risk, and I think we see kids who go to school and shoot up schools who often are not particularly physically imposing, but the weapons make a big difference as to when they can decide and use serious violence against others. But, you know, if you look into the background of people who have committed really serious violent acts, you will always, I would say, I mean, Athens' model is a causal model. It's not a correlational model, which means he found this pattern in 100% of the violent criminals he studied. And I have looked at other cases, and it's always there if you look carefully. It isn't always reported, but if you can find the information, you will find previous minor violent performances and even sometimes major. The two kids who shot up the Columbine High School had already started carrying weapons in their car had started fighting back against the football players who'd been pushing them around and who had begun to seriously threaten other people. So they didn't just one day snap and go to school and kill a bunch of people. They learned their way toward this process. They tried violence, and it worked for them. And this is another aspect of Athens' model that's intriguing. Kids who have been violently dominated and who have felt themselves to be victims and who have been treated with disrespect and with contempt by other people, suddenly when they use violence, the whole world changes for them. People begin to show them respect. People begin to back off when they walk into the room. And that's a very heady and powerful experience. You know, it's one of the commonplaces of criminology that violent people supposedly have low self-esteem. And when they're being victimized, they often do have low self-esteem. But they certainly don't have self-esteem, low self-esteem, when they have gone through violent experiences. To the contrary, Athens found that violent criminals in general had way, way overvalued themselves in terms of thinking of themselves as the cock of the walk, because they knew that they could handle situations that previously had been threatening to them.
Is there a different model to explain people like Jeffrey Dahmer, who I don't think went through those four stages?
No, he must have gone through all four of those stages. We just haven't seen any cases where, when you finally get the level of detail, that these four stages aren't revealed. So, you know, I understand that Dahmer had supposedly a good life with his parents, but there had to be something else. You know, it had to have been treatment in the neighborhood or at the school, and he had to have experienced those four stages. I think that often we just don't have the level of detail, and so we're not privy to the kind of detail that would show us that he had gone through all four stages.
People don't necessarily, reporters in particular, don't necessarily know what to look for. Or if you take the case again of Dylan and Klebold, the two boys of the Columbine High School shootings, I looked very carefully into their family backgrounds to see where their violent socialization took place. And it wasn't with their parents.
Right.
But one of them grew up on an Air Force base where there was a lot of bullying going on in the streets. And, you know, the night before Klebold and Harris went to Columbine and did their shooting, they made videotapes where they talked about why. And one of them in particular said, I grew up on an Air Force base and I got kicked around all the time. And the other one said, my older brother was a football player and he and his football player friends used to beat up on me all the time. So if you can find it in the record and if someone has had a sense of looking for it, it's always there.
And I think that touches on a point, too, about mistreatment. We are certainly more sensitive about bullying, and there is a lot of work across the United States in school districts to try and address that, which is a whole other subject. But I think that we often disregard things that happen to kids, especially if it's kid on kid, as boys will be boys, or that's just the way kids sort things out on the playground. And I think that we, again, because we don't really understand often what we're looking for, we disregard things that are significant, very significant, especially in the life of a child. Once again, you know, as adults, it's easy to imagine that kids aren't so impacted by things, but they are.
There was a 6-year-old some years ago who took a gun to school and shot a classmate. And from the point of view of reporting about the case, there was no explanation for his behavior. But it turned out that he had spent his previous years of childhood living with his mother in a crack house. And the possibility that he was not exposed to serious violent domination, I would say under those circumstances, was probably zero. So it's there, but people don't look because they don't have a model as to why people become violent, or they have an erroneous model that has emerged over the over the years from other attempts by other sociologists and psychiatrists to explain violence without doing what Dr. Athens did, which is actually investigate the social experiences of violence in the backgrounds of violent criminals. That's what's so crucial, I think, about his work. He actually went to the source and looked at classic examples of violent people and questioned them at great length about their previous experiences of violence, usually all the way back to their first experiences as children for the younger men whom he interviewed, and found what they 100% of them all had in common in terms of violent social experiences. That's why his model qualifies, I think, for a really breakthrough explanation as to why people are violent.
We're talking to Richard Rhodes and Ginger Rhodes about violence as socialization. So how is this four-stage violent socialization similar to and different from the training for violence that people receive in the military or in the police?
It really parallels the military. In fact, I think it's pretty clear that the military over the centuries evolved a training program to make soldiers capable of using lethal violence in battle, evolved it from this, if you will, common human pattern that has evolved informally over the centuries to prepare people to use violence in conflict as civilians. Where it differs is military stop violent socialization, or try to, at stage three, which Athens calls marginal violence or defensive violence, where you are prepared to use serious violence, but only to protect yourself and the people you value. Lots of people in our society, lots of men in particular, are socialized to the level of defensive violence and stay there. They don't think of themselves as violent. They don't walk around feeling, I'm tough and I'm violent and I can use violence whenever I want something from anybody. Rather, they just think, well, if I have to, I'll do this because that's the way I was taught to protect myself. But in modern war, it's very tricky to keep people at defensive violent levels simply because the weapons are so lethal. The circumstances can be so much more confusing. Modern war is so much more involved with civilian casualties than it used to be. I mean, soldiers used to go out on a battlefield and confront a line of soldiers from the other side, and they would fight, and then whoever won would win. But we're in a very different world now, and I think when you see, well, the famous case that I talk about in my book, Why They Kill, is the atrocities in the My Lai massacre in the war in Vietnam. Those soldiers had been so much mixed up in the middle of civilian fighting because it was basically a guerrilla war, that they reached the point where they didn't think they could tell the difference between civilians and combatants anymore. And as far as they were concerned, every Vietnamese was an enemy. So they were prepared to walk through a village and kill everyone in the village, which is basically what they did. Even then, some of the American soldiers were not prepared to use violence under those circumstances and walked right through the village without ever opening fire on anyone and walked out the other side.
I think an important point right there to underscore is the fact that people have rules. They have rules about when they use violence. And soldiers and police have rules that are agreed upon. Our society agrees to limit the extent, and we establish the rules, and they follow those rules. But even what Athens calls dangerous violent criminals, they have rules. They have rules when they use violence. They have rules against whom they use violence. So there are rules, and everyone adheres to those rules with some exceptions, like Richard is talking about, in terms of people who cross them for various reasons.
In Athens' own family, he grew up in a violent household. His father beat up on the boys, but not the girls. His father didn't believe in hitting women. You know, and I think it's important to be aware that violent people, even criminally violent people, do have a set of rules that they follow. They don't just snap. They don't just always use violence in every circumstance. As the police like to say, you don't see many murders committed in the presence of a uniformed police officer.
Exactly.
That gives the lie to the notion that violence is somehow involuntary or impulsive. Every time someone uses violence, they go through a decision-making process. It may take place very quickly. We value people who can make up their minds fast under circumstances of stress, but there is a process of thinking it through.
Several years ago, when we were back east, I was working in the intake jail in one of the states. And I had been working with a juvenile who had just recently been arrested, and he was pretty proud of himself. He had done his first major violent performance. He'd beaten up his dad and gotten busted into jail. And I talked with him weekly over the course of a few weeks, and he kept going on about how he had just snapped, and, you know, he was a mean, scary dude, and, you know, like I said, he was pretty proud of himself. He kept telling me how he was just out of control, and he couldn't control it. It was impulsive on his part. And then 3 or 4 weeks in, he came in one day, and there had been trouble on the wing where he was, and he had been talking about how he was going to beat up a CO, a correction officer, but she was a woman, and he said he stopped. He couldn't do that, and he became aware that he had a rule that he wouldn't beat up women. He was perfectly able to beat up on men, but he wouldn't beat up on women. So that really belied his whole idea that it was impulsive and he had just snapped. He was perfectly capable of stopping himself, and he had a rule.
It's interesting to think about this in terms of Vietnam, because, of course, the My Lai massacre is very famous, but there are so many other incidents of kind of cultures of violence among American soldiers who would recreationally cut off people's ears, rape women, cut people's body parts, and there are entire subcultures of men in their 60s now who are still dealing with the guilt and horror of what they did. And there's therapists who are working with those men who are old now, but when they were doing it, they seemed really not to have any rules.
You know, when the military tries to train soldiers to limit their violence to defensive violence, one of the reasons that's part of military tradition is that then they can come home and reintegrate into society fairly comfortably, because they never really imagined themselves, thought of themselves, envisioned themselves as violent individuals. Whereas when soldiers, and you know, Jonathan Shea, a Boston psychiatrist, has written eloquently about what happened to our men in Vietnam, a wonderful book of his called Achilles in Vietnam, where he talks about what happens when soldiers are not handled well by their officers, who are encouraged to produce body count rather than something less horrendous than that, and they slip over into malefic violence rather than defensive violence, which we would in civilian life call criminal levels of violence. In Vietnam, there was sadly a lot of that, and it was manifested exactly in things like war atrocities and taking body trophies, and famously at My Lai. Shea finds that, or indicts the officers, the military leadership, really, for not helping their men stay within the safe confines of defensive violence in war.
And I think the rule in that case is, you are not part of my group. I don't need to protect you. You are not, you know, I don't consider you to be of the human group.
Wait, who's not considering who?
in talking about the men who committed those kinds of atrocities, that the victims of those atrocities would not be part of their group. You are not part of my group. I consider you subhuman. You know, I consider you not worthy of basic protections.
Well, that has to be true of all military training, otherwise nobody could kill anybody.
No, that's not actually true. I mean, if you look over the literature of war, you find many people who were soldiers in war talking with great admiration about their enemies, depending on how honorable their enemies were.
Exactly.
The irony of war is that there are rules. I mean, we think of soldiers who are just sent out to slaughter, and that's not the case at all. There are rules, and if the other side seems to follow a set of honorable rules, then in some grudging way they are respected as well. It's when the rules are broken, when, for example, non-combatants are killed or slaughtered in numbers, when the other side doesn't respect taking prisoners and slaughters prisoners rather than treating them as prisoners of war. These are the things that lead one side to feel contempt, what Athens would call malefic violence, which is hatred-based violence against the other side rather than something a little more honorable. I mean, it's ironic because one of the facts of the modern world, and in the United States in particular, is that our levels of violence, paradoxically, are so low today that most people no longer have any personal experience of violence, certainly not of major violence at all, which is why I think people can come to the conclusion that watching television can make you violent, that violent people are mentally ill. They aren't at any higher levels than the rest of the population. And the mentally ill don't use violence at any higher levels than the rest of the population. That people are mentally ill, that violence is a mental disorder. Violence is a kit of tools. And in the hands of people we designate as professionally violent, our police and our soldiers, we consider it perfectly honorable to use violence under the right legal conditions. And, of course, dishonorable when they don't. The situation in Ferguson, Missouri, circles around the question of whether the police officer used violence appropriately or not. And we have a mechanism for adjudicating those issues, which is courts of law. So even our professionally violent have to operate within a set of legal rules, or we indict them as being violently, criminally violent, because they didn't follow those rules.
Do you think those courts of laws work?
Well, that's another question. And, of course, there's a strong feeling, particularly within the African-American community, and an understandable feeling given the history of the treatment of African-Americans in American society, that maybe those rules don't work for them.
I think there's a real question about how we protect children in our society. The family, it's difficult to get into the family. It's a pretty protected zone. You know, we certainly have laws, but there's state-to-state laws, and there's still a big discussion about how adults are allowed to treat their own children. And until we consistently protect kids, they'll be exposed to these kinds of experiences, and they have an impact. There are results.
So within the family is another zone where the legal system has only limited venue because, understandably, we don't particularly want to have a police officer sitting at our dining room table with us when we're at home. But because the standards of how you treat or mistreat children have been evolving over the centuries, really, but dramatically in the United States in recent years, you know, the first paper on child abuse in the scientific literature in the United States was written by a radiologist, published by a radiologist in 1946. Before then, there really weren't very clear lines of demarcation about what kind of treatment of children was legal and what was not legal. He wrote a paper about seeing characteristic twisting fractures in the legs of infants when he x-rayed them in his medical practice, fractures consistent with someone twisting a child's leg until the bone broke, horrible as that sounds. When I was a boy at the age of 12, I was remitted to a benevolent children's home because my stepmother was starving my brother and me and beating us. But I remember vividly talking with the social worker years later, and she said, "We didn't know what to do with you boys. After all, you had two parents." She said, "But you were so obviously starved, we realized we had to get you out of there." So even in 1949, when this happened to me at the age of 12, it wasn't at all clear-cut about how you protect children within the family. And it's still a zone of debate within the United States.
It certainly still is, as a psychologist. You know, there are plenty of professional communities that try to support the family, try to keep it together. And there's a real question about when we should be supporting families and when we should be intervening and doing something for the kids,
and
not
how,
just
how
the family.
Do you get in, how do you get inside the family? One of the ways that we've identified that has had great and documented success is programs of home nursing, developed originally in Colorado and now in some 43 states around the United States. A trained public health nurse visits new mothers, typically when they're pregnant, with their first child, and then continues the visits, usually on a once-a-month basis for only an hour, until the child is two. They have found 50% reductions in hospital admissions for physical abuse in families under those circumstances. So there are methods for getting at this problem of within the family without major intrusions by the law. And they work simply because the home visiting nurse is able to tell the mother when the mother, let's say, is hitting a child because the child is crying, well, look, maybe the child isn't just being willful. Maybe it needs a bottle. Maybe it needs its diapers changed. Let's try that. And the mothers learn in a safe context to think somewhat differently about their child's behavior than they might have thought before.
We're talking to Richard and Ginger Rhodes about violent socialization. There's another piece that I wanted to ask you about. When you take a step back from the families where this kind of socialization for violence is going on, then you have situations of economic inequality and economic injustice, particularly in African American communities where the rate of violence and the rate of homicide is orders of magnitude higher than it is in other subcultures. You've got poorly paid jobs, you've got unemployment. These things lead to drug dealing, which is illegal. Therefore, that leads to gangs, which leads to the kind of violence that you're talking about. So, I mean, family intervention is one thing, but then there's this kind of bigger economic and social picture.
You know, the problem with violence in inner cities is not an economic problem per se. Of course, economic problems stress people. And if they've been socialized to be violent, they might use violence more frequently because they drink, because they're stressed. But the truth is, the alternative to violence in any society is the rule of law. And inner cities are not protected by the police to the same degree as white suburbs are. If you want to talk to police, if you want to look at what they do, you will find that they don't intervene within the ghetto at the same level of protection as people get in middle-class communities outside the ghetto. That's the real reason. That's the real problem. Gangs form, at least in part, because kids have to find ways to protect themselves from each other. And one of the ways they do that is to revert back to the way violence used to be controlled in all of societies before the advent of the rule of law, before the advent of social controls over violence. And that was basically by feuding. you go back to the famous Scottish Highlands or the Appalachia of America, you find that if your clan, someone in your group got attacked by someone in the other group, you retaliated against anyone in the other group, and thereby basically made everybody stop and think, are we sure we want to do this? Do we really want to take this guy down because he's alone on the street late at night? Because if we do, we're going to have that whole family on our heads next week. So that was a method of violence control. Gangs, in a sense, are a method of violence control, among other things. And the reason that people have to put up their own methods of controlling violence is because they don't have equal access to courts of law, because they don't have equal quality of policing. So it's really a larger problem than simply that economic inequality leads people. Economic inequality does not lead people to be violent. There are other communities that have economic inequality all over the world that are not particularly violent because they have other ways of controlling violence.
It's interesting to hear what you're saying, because there's another narrative from, for example, the streets of New York, where there are Black and Latino neighborhoods where especially young men who walk around in their neighborhoods say that there's too much police presence there, but it's directed against basically anybody. It's the stop and frisk thing. It's the Ferguson problem. It's the problem of police not protecting the people in that neighborhood, but actually being violent against them.
And there again, you have the difficult problem in our society of the relationship among the races, the relationship. I mean, the police are trained to be violently dominant. That's their job. The problem is when it slips over into a culture of let's hassle these kids, they're going to be trouble. Let's make some easy arrests because it looks good on the record. These are problems of corruption, fundamentally. And there, the solution, obviously, is better training for the police and better supervision for the police.
And, you know, I think in all of these examples, there's something to keep in mind, and that is that not 100% of the people in these economically disadvantaged communities are violent. You know, not 100% of the people in these communities that don't have adequate police protection or maybe have police being too dominant in them, not 100% of those people are violent. So again, the question is, why are some people in a situation and why are other people, why are some people violent and why are other people not violent? And I think that's the power of Athens' model, is that it shows us clearly the parts that it takes, the kind of really training, if you will, that it takes for someone to learn to use violence to address these problems. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. Why two people with the same outward experience would handle things in different ways? And that's what violent socialization, I think, helps us understand.
What kinds of interventions can be done and at what stages to interrupt the process of violent socialization?
Well, the first thing that we can do is protect kids from being violently dominated.
And then, of course, we immediately move to the question of how you get within the family. What we've been trying to identify recently since we published the books we have is how do you do that? The first way that we found is home nursing. And it seems clear that that's been so successful that it's rapidly spreading across the country. As I said, there seem to be 43 state programs around the United States now that have to do with home nursing, going into homes and helping new mothers and new parents learn how to take care of their children without necessarily beating them, mistreating them. But what they found in the research is that once the program stops, and this one I just described stops at age 2, I've seen others that run up through age 4 and 5. Once it stops, there tends to be some slippage and the levels of child abuse tend to go up again. So the next thing that we've identified is a program that was originally started in Vermont back in 1980 that was the development of what were called child-parent centers, one in particular in Addison, Vermont, they bussed families in with their children for childcare. They provided a community center where all sorts of state and non-government services could kind of come together in one place to provide training to parents and recreation to children, all in a context of peace and learning not to mistreat your children. This was then studied very thoroughly by researchers at the University of Vermont, and they found a 50% reduction in teenage pregnancies, a 50% reduction in hospital admissions for deliberate injuries, and so on and so on. Vermont was so happy with the program that they replicated it in every county in the state, and it is now being looked at elsewhere and has been promulgated elsewhere. But here's a way, two ways in turn, the home visiting and the community center that brings together services and recreational services, two ways to get at the problem of violence within families and also violence in the community.
And I think one way that you can think about the impact of those programs is it is nonviolent coaching. If the violent coach teaches the novice, you know, the person who's in the situation trying to figure out how in the heck not to be dominated by these brutal people, if the violent coach gives them the direct message that the only way out is through violent action themselves, in these kinds of programs, they're really providing alternative ideas about how to deal with their lives. So there's a way in which you could see it as nonviolent coaching.
In a sense, what the violent coach does for the novice is basically flood their alternatives with one important alternative that in a way blinds the novice to the other possibilities. After all, you could run away from home. You could, as Dr. Athens did and I did, go to the library all the time and kind of hide out there to get away from this mistreatment. You could, as some teenagers do, very sadly, but it's one alternative to being violently dominated. You could commit suicide. Those are all ways to avoid this situation that's so intolerable. But it's even better when you have a community that has provided alternatives and encourages and educates you in those alternatives. The other programs that we've identified that seems to be successful, often be even without their realizing why, because they're not aware of the violent socialization model, is anti-bullying programs in schools. I've looked at some recent research that indicated that the kind of anti-bullying programs in schools that just focus on the kids who are being bullied are actually not successful. But what is successful is when the whole school, I mean, in a sense, this is the replication of a peaceful community, when the whole school gets involved, and when there's zero tolerance for bullying, when people are rewarded for not bullying.
And when, one other thing in there, when the adults, all the teachers and the administrators are clear as to what the rules are and what the consequences will be if people break the rules.
So there are programs out there, and we're just really beginning to understand how they might be dispersed across the land, if you will. And they would really benefit from understanding Athens research better and knowing about it. One of the reasons we give lectures is to promulgate the model, because a lot of the ways people have found that they hope will deal with violence don't really have any basis in evidence. Here is an evidence-based model for how you make someone violent that can be used to authenticate the kind of prevention and intervention programs that we were just describing.
Dr. Ginger Rhodes is a clinical psychologist in San Francisco. Richard Rhodes is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of many books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb. They will be giving a talk tonight called Why We Kill, Violence as Socialization. It's at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. It's free and open to the public, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. You can find out more at santafe.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.